I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Being unhoused can be dangerous at any time of year. Life without permanent shelter in the winter adds the risk of weather-related injuries or death to an already untenable list of problems. Are service providers and advocates for vulnerable Alaskans able to keep up with the demand for food, shelter, and medical care as winter's grip deepens? We'll discuss addressing the needs for Alaskans experiencing homelessness today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The ability to close a door, lock it, and sleep in a secure building is something most don't think much about and often take for granted. Unless you've experienced the crisis of homelessness, it can be hard to understand how it happens to people and what works best for getting them into stable housing again. The high cost of living here, made worse by months of high inflation, means many Alaskans right now are one unexpected expense away from being unable to pay the rent or the mortgage. That's a scary proposition at any time, but especially so during Alaskan winters. So who assists people who need financial help to get through the month so they can stay in their home? And who helps Alaskans who lose their housing and need a warm, safe place to stay? With us today are three people who dedicate their work to helping vulnerable Alaskans across the state. Brian Wilson is the executive director of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness and joins us by Zoom. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us today. In the studio with me is Meg Zalatel. Meg is the executive director of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness. Meg is also a member of the Anchorage Assembly, but she is here today only in her capacity as executive director of the Anchorage Coalition. Hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And also in the studio is Eileen Arnold. Eileen happens to be in Anchorage right now, but she lives in Bethel, where she is the executive director of the Tundra Women's Coalition. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sorry that you got stuck in Anchorage, but it's a happy event for us so that we can have you with us today. You can also join our conversation, Alaskans. Are you in need of assistance in your community and want to know how to access resources? Do you see a need for housing and services in your area and want to know how to address it? And do you have ideas for how to help more Alaskans have a safe place to live? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 907-550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Brian, start us off with an overview of the need statewide. Do you have an idea of how many Alaskans are without housing or at risk of losing housing currently?
Yeah, thanks, Lori, for the question. So, Alaska is a unique state when it comes to homelessness. The federal government looks at homelessness by a set of definitions, namely looking at individuals that don't have a safe and stable house. In Alaska, it really looks different depending what community you're in, because we just do not have the resources to address the need, particularly in our rural communities. We conduct an annual count every January called the point in time count, which is counting folks in emergency shelter and unsheltered folks. And every year that results in about 2,000 Alaskans that are in unsheltered homelessness or sheltered homelessness. But unfortunately, that count is limited to the communities that have the programs to count people. So unfortunately, in most of our rural communities, they're seeing high levels of severe overcrowding in their communities because people are just all piling into homes to escape the weather. So the need is far outweighs the numbers that we're reporting up to the federal government. And it's honestly kind of creates a challenging situation for our organization to put an exact number on the amount of Alaskans that are in housing instability.
And I'm sure that it's very fluid and dynamic and changes often. And Eileen will be able to help us better understand the overcrowding in rural areas in just a moment. But Brian, I want to stay with you for just a minute. Talk briefly about the programs that are offered to help people avoid falling into homelessness and the expense difference between when you can help people make it through the month or whatever crisis they're having so they can stay in place versus once they're out of housing, what it takes to get people back on track?
Yeah, that's a great question that I don't think we talk about enough. In our world, the best outcome is diverting somebody's instance of homelessness. As you mentioned in the intro, many Alaskans are just one missed paycheck away from falling into a houseless situation. And so the state has a program called the Housing Assistance Program, which is our primary means for housing prevention, which is a highly effective program. We measure returns to homelessness if for the people that receive those funds, and over 9 out of 10 households who receive prevention support do not fall into homelessness later on. Which is great until that money runs out. And as you mentioned, when somebody does fall into an unsheltered situation, there's a variety of complicating factors that makes it a lot more difficult to get that person back into a household. And that gets a lot more expensive at the end of the day to treat those individuals, particularly when we get into more rural communities where the cost of housing and services are exponentially higher than our more densely populated areas.
Well, and also, of course, if people actually do experience a crisis where they're out of their housing, all kinds of other complications can pop up that, you know, it's not safe if you have to stay in a place where you can't lock a door. And so there's other things that could happen in the interim that could make the situation even worse, as I'm sure you well know. So thank you for getting us started there. I want to remind our listeners that this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about how homelessness is a statewide issue. And in the studio with me today is Meg Zalatel. Meg is the executive director of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness. And Eileen Arnold is also in the studio with us. She is the executive director of the Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel. And Brian Wilson is on the line. He is the executive director of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Eileen, how much need are you seeing this year at the Bethel Winter House, and how does that compare to past years?
Well, the Bethel Winter House seems like it is serving more and more people every year. Last year, unduplicated, there were 331 people who accessed services. And so far this year, the Bethel Winter House has been open for 8 weeks, and they've already seen 175 unduplicated people. That 331 from last year's season is more, I think it was 227 the year before that, and 200-something the year before that. So we're increasing, and I think part of that is the pandemic. But I also think part of that is just more people knowing the services that we have, and also the Bethel Winter House going into a permanent facility, which we were able to do with some renovation COVID money through our housing coalition. So the numbers are increasing, but I don't think that's because there's an increased need. I think that there is just an increased knowledge of the services and the infrastructure that we're building.
Well, although it's unfortunate to see more and more numbers. It is at least good that people know of the services and you know, can avail themselves of them so that they're not sleeping in dangerous conditions outdoors.
Absolutely. The Bethel Winter House was created simply to save people's lives so that people wouldn't freeze in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And those founders of the Bethel Winter House should be really proud of what they built and what we continue to sustain. And the Bethel Winter House is also a really critical access point, besides being just a safety net to stop people from freezing in the middle of the night, but also for us to gather data on what would solve a person's homelessness. Is it a temporary thing where a person just got stuck in Bethel because of weather on their way to a village? Or is it something that is a chronic homelessness issue where they need more wraparound services or the permanent supportive housing that we are building right now in Bethel?
Tell us just a little bit more about what the Winter House is for folks that don't know, and how you're doing right now. In an earlier interview, you mentioned that it costs about $360,000 to operate the Winter House during the winter, and you mentioned that you're trying to make it on considerably less, $250,000. What's that going to mean?
Right. Well, as we all know, budgeting is an art and not a science, and there are definitely some tight years, and this is a tight year for the Bethel Winter House. And it's been very difficult for the Bethel Winter House to get into some of those sustaining funding streams at the state of Alaska. And part of that is because those funding streams are trending more towards permanent solutions, which is very important and critical. And we're accessing those as well. And, you know, in 2024, should be able to open a 24-unit permanent supportive housing. But in the meantime, we need to fund our safety net. And there hasn't been an increase, I believe, in you know, that safety net for homelessness in the state of Alaska for quite some time. And I think that there needs to be, because even once permanent supportive housing is built, people are still going to need to access the Bethel Winter House. And that's really the access point for us to start to identify who needs services. So it's always going to be critically important to have sort of the full spectrum of the safety net available for permanent solutions and temporary solutions, and even just that place for people who are just stuck on their way to a village.
And you also provide a lot more than just emergency shelter for people who are escaping violence. Talk about the legal services that you assist people with.
Sure. And, you know, for people who are listening, I'm the executive director of the Tundra Women's Coalition, which is a different shelter from the Bethel Winter House. But the Tundra Women's Coalition leads the housing coalition in Bethel. So that's how I'm involved and know so much about the Bethel Winter House. So at the Tundra Women's Coalition, that is a shelter for people escaping domestic and sexual violence. And then, of course, we have services for everything else that a person might need, because if a person has made a decision to leave a violent home, then they sort of need to rebuild their lives. And that's unfortunate that the burden falls on the victim and survivor of violence. But what we've found people to need who come to our shelter is a lot of legal services, legal advocacy, like protective orders, like divorce and custody are the main things, like access to an affordable lawyer. And then also sometimes just court accompaniment, because that stuff is confusing. And especially for people who've experienced trauma, it can be difficult to understand. There's so many court hearings, you might miss one. That is critically important. Letting people know how they can track if their offender is coming out of jail through, VineLink and all those different notification things. We also have a housing program within our organization to just help people find housing, because that is a, you know, the waiting list for affordable housing in Bethel is something like 18 months. It's very long. And if you're coming from a village and you have to like get a job and you have how many children, it's very difficult to find a job that would support you in any of the rentals that exist out in Bethel. Across the whole state of Alaska, there's a housing crunch. It's difficult to find affordable housing. And that's even more true in Bethel. That's even more true in the villages. And it's just tough all around.
And, you know, it's critical, the services that you're providing to people who are in crisis, because, as you know, it's difficult to think clearly. When you're in trauma, you forget things. You can't operate as effectively as you would if you weren't under a lot of stress and tension. So it's great to have those reminders about those critical dates and hearings and things. So thank you. Meg, thank you for your patience. I want to get to you now. Yesterday, the Bronson administration asked the Anchorage Assembly to increase the number of beds at the Sullivan Arena, the city's emergency shelter, from 200 to 360. And I know you're here, as we mentioned, as the executive director of the Anchorage Coalition, not as an assembly member, but as the coalition director, what do you think about this request?
Yeah, thanks for that question. We were surprised by it. We have, as a coalition, we're a convener. We've been working really closely with providers in the community. We had started out with the Emergency Cold Weather Task Force. It's now sustained as an Emergency Shelter Task Force, just kind of looking at capacity needs, system needs, and it's really focused on data. And we hadn't heard a concern about capacity, particularly at the Sullivan Arena. And so we're working with our governance structure at the coalition, the advisory council, to likely ask the government, the municipality, to take a pause on doing an increase. Let's take some time to look at the data. Let's see what the data bears out. I think in your introduction, you said it's fluid and dynamic. That's absolutely true. So we can't just look at one facility. We need to look at what is outreach seeing, what are the other emergency cold weather shelters seeing for utilization, and what is Brother Francis seeing? So we want to take a moment, convene with our partners, look at this data, have a conversation, and say, one, are we really exceeding capacity by up to 160 individuals? Is a smaller capacity increase warranted? And what does that mean for resources to the system? Because what we have seen is consistent capacity constraints that have been sustained and supported by the data for transition-aged youth and families. And so if we make this investment and increase capacity for single adults in a resource finite system, are we now leaving others out in the cold? So we really do need to take an in-depth look at this. So we are going to be asking, as the coalition and the continuum of care, for a pause.
And you were saying you haven't heard concerns about capacity. Who are you referencing when you say you haven't heard concerns? From the administration or from the shelters themselves, the providers themselves?
Either. We haven't heard concerns about capacity. We knew that Brother Francis was likely going to stay at capacity because if there's openings at Brother Francis, folks from the Sullivan Arena are going over to Brother Francis, which is fine. But we have street outreach who's not seeing, you know, massive numbers of people with nowhere to go. We talk with people. We say there is shelter. We haven't heard from the health department, who's one of our very close partners and who oversees these contracts at these facilities, that there is an issue around capacity. We haven't heard from the operator of these three shelters that there isn't enough capacity. So all of those just require us to take a pause. Let's look at the data and make data-driven decisions.
In the story that was written up in the Anchorage Daily News excuse me, today about the Bronson request, there was a quote from one of his spokespeople that said, people are being told they can't sleep in the outdoor warming area, that people are coming into that at night. What do you know about that?
So the warming area has traditionally been a place where you don't get to lay down. It's not for habitation, and there usually aren't hot meals served. There are usually snacks and warm beverages, and it is meant as a temporary location to get warm. It's not meant for overnight. You know, you could be there overnight, but it's not meant for you to shelter. Mm. So there is that distinction. So it's a little bit different. Basically, it prevents, you know, the fire marshal is involved any time that you have overnight accommodations and some of those things. Good news is this year they managed to carve out a section of the Sullivan Arena. So it's actually an indoor warming area versus a tent out in the parking lot. But those same restrictions still apply. But that quote in the paper suggesting there are 160 people in that warming area, you know, they'd be shoulder to shoulder. We just don't have any data to suggest that that's the case. And if that is the case, we need to figure out what's the miss. Why don't we know about that? Because we're a system and we work together and we communicate a lot and we use data to make our decisions. So if we're having that miss, we need to take a little bit of time to figure out what that is.
In an earlier interview before today, you said there is a need for 500 to 700 housing units. And your quote was to make a dent in the number of individuals experiencing homelessness for housing. That seems like a staggering number, especially in Anchorage, where available land to build on is tight. How do you see this being accomplished?
Yeah, great question. A bite at a time, quite frankly. You know, we've had great success. We brought on 110 housing units at the guest house. There are two Smenard locations that are looking at hotel conversions. That's a start. And all told, if those three are all to completion, that's 300 housing units. So it's not impossible. And it's a matter of priorities and investment. I think earlier, it was explained very well. There's that tension between the emergency safety net and the longer term investment. The solution to homelessness is housing. So if we're intending to solve homelessness, we have to make investments in housing. And we need to maintain a safety net to keep people alive and well in the meantime. So I'm hopeful that we can continue to look for conversions of properties, bringing on properties that aren't habitable right now. The Landlord Housing Partnership through United Way has rehabilitation funds for some units. So if we really look and be creative, I think there are units out there. The vacancy factor is terrible in Anchorage right now. It has been sub 4% for a while, and rents are really expensive. It hasn't been an issue of getting enough rental monies, though. We have rental assistance. More is coming through Anchorage from emergency rental assistance. It's literal units. And so I think if we put our heads together and stay focused on the housing side of things and make those capital investments, those longer term investments, we can start to chip away at that number. I don't think it's insurmountable.
All right. Well, thank you. We are going to go to the phones for a moment. Duke is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for taking the call. I will try to be succinct, but I have a difficult time doing that sometimes. I started coming out to Centennial Park early when the first days of the camp was there and started serving burritos on the back of my scooter. And I did it for about 3 weeks until there was an article in the paper about me doing that, and I was asked to leave. Essentially, mutual aid is a very powerful tool that the community actually used this summer until the Salvation Army diverted all of the donations to Centennial Park, to their main service area. And when they sort of took over, that's when I was sort of asked to leave. But essentially, they promised, and I heard this directly from the guy, promised food tents, washer dryer trailers, all of these amenities that were going to help the situation, and none of it materialized. So that was a huge lie and a big disappointment. I continued to give food to an outreach there after I got removed, and then I went on to Mountain View. Now, my point is, there is an incredible need. There's a huge need, and I see people every day that I'm out at Alliance Park by the McCary Street Bridge, serving between 50 and 75 people in a super camp just a few hundred yards away. There's at least 100 people there. Some choose to be there, but essentially you've got old and the infirmed. You have people like getting food and bringing it back to camp. You know, you have a society of people who are banding together to survive. But every day, you know, I see people hypothermic. They're making bad choices, but man, you know, it's dire. And I'm just one guy, but essentially, you know, being able to feed, you know, 50, 75 people from the back of my car is very rewarding. And I've gotten a small army of people to help me, too, and various other businesses and other things have been sort of supporting my actions.
Well, Duke, I've certainly seen your posts on Instagram and the work that you're doing just as a citizen helping other citizens. And it sounds like you've been able to get others to join that cause. Thank you for the call. And so I'd like our guest to kind of reflect back on that, people doing that sort of direct action assistance like Duke is engaging in, where he's, you know, either making food and taking it to the community fridge in Mountain View, or he's actually serving people right at the park. What are your thoughts about people doing these kinds of things?
Well, in rural Alaska, I'd say that that's the only name in the game, or had been the only name in the game for a very long time, mm-hmm. and still is in the in rural communities, because, you know, you can't be homeless in rural Alaska where it is so cold and the weather is so unforgiving. Somebody is going to house you. So in Bethel, we have created a little bit more infrastructure with between the Bethel Winter House and the permanent supportive housing that we are building that is going to be co-located with the Bethel Winter House and, of course, the Tundra Women's Coalition. But even still, I think there's a lot of people, and this is part of the overcrowding that we keep talking about in rural Alaska, like, you can't be literally homeless in rural Alaska because you will be literally dead.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of family members, extended family members, friends who are housing each other because there's literally no other option.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, great for the caller who just spoke about his efforts. That's a critical part of the safety net as well, especially when there's a lack of infrastructure.
People helping people. Absolutely. One of the things that we've engaged in the past is like direct action glove handouts and, you know, giving people just buying some gloves and taking them around to folks that look like they're cold and could use a pair of gloves. I want to go back to you, Brian, and Meg, maybe you can jump in here too. The services that are needed to help people regain stability are often in what's called a navigation center. So what does that mean? What is a navigation center and how does that help?
Sure, I'll take a crack at this one. And actually, before I jump into it, I'll do a shameless plug. There's no shortage of need out there. There's no organization in any community that can address homelessness within their community alone. And there's always ways that people can get involved to volunteer with their local service providers. And so if you are curious, it could be something as easy as a donation of clothing or your time. It really looks different depending on where you are. And I wouldn't hesitate to reach out to any local providers that you know, because I'm sure that they have a laundry list of things that could help them do their jobs better. In terms of navigation, I think it's such an important element here because housing is the pure solution to homelessness, hard stop. It is a very complex system of services to navigate, especially if you're somebody experiencing housing instability trauma. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the programs that we fund have navigation components in there to take the burden off of the person who is experiencing that trauma and onto somebody who is trained and has developed relationships with a variety of stakeholders locally that can assist this person as easily as possible. So some communities that are larger can stand up navigation centers where it's co-located services, kind of one-stop shopping. You show up and there are people there to help you. And in other communities, particularly our rural communities, they're relying on outreach components and navigators that can meet the clients where they're at to ensure that they are having the straightest line possible to that help without having to call 10 different people and get on 5 different wait lists just to receive help.
Mm-hmm. Meg, I see you nodding your head. You want to add in there?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And we at the Coalition, we have taken this outreach coordination piece to where we're really trying to decentralize navigation, take navigation to the people. So we do pop-ups in coordination with service providers at various community locations, really centering this idea that you don't have to go to any one place in order to access services. For a long time, Anchorage wasn't a housing first community. It wasn't street to housed. It was street to shelter, to shelter, to shelter, to housed. And we're trying to say, yes, you can go to shelter if you choose. That's great. Client choice is always at the center of this, but you shouldn't have to go to a particular place in order to connect with services. And so we're really focused on bringing services to people where they are, whether that's in a lot of the places that Duke is, or whether that's at the library, or whether that is at a shelter. Navigation doesn't have to occur in a particular place in order to have it occur, to have it be effective.
And are there people going out to camps or how are you reaching out beyond the library and other gathering places in the city?
Yeah, in partnership with the municipality, the coalition received a grant to do what we call enhanced street outreach. So we work with service providers. We coordinate that based on where we know people to be, where we know noticed abatements to be. We have these two pop-up events each week. At those pop-up events, we bring medics, we bring supplies, we bring food, really trying to just create a good relationship with individuals. We are a trusted entity. We are here to meet your needs. And if you want to engage with us further so that we can get your data, we can connect you with a coordinated entry assessment, which is on the step to housing, we can do that, and we can do that on the spot. And the municipality really has been a partner for us because they've been able to fund our technology. They've agreed to allow us to buy a shower trailer to take out to the people to where we can really meet needs first, because it's a trauma-informed response. Let's meet your needs before we ask you for anything or ask you to engage. And so we're doing that, whether that's going out to camps or being in some static locations. It's really the focus.
All right, we are going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue our discussion about homelessness being a statewide issue and the service providers and folks who are trying to help those who are vulnerable as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Would you like to play a part in the public media you enjoy? Consider becoming a member or corporate sponsor. Contact your public radio station to learn how. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Money is generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are talking about homelessness as winter deepens in our state and how all of us will get to ways in this next half hour about ideas for how everyone can pitch in and help. We heard from Duke, who is doing direct action assistance here in Anchorage by feeding people and taking food to the community refrigerator and also providing meals in a local park. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide to call if you'd like to join our conversation, if you have ideas or you have questions. 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 907-550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. We have Brian Wilson, the Executive Director of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, Meg Zalatel, the Executive Director of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, and Eileen Arnold, Executive Director of the Tundra Women's Coalition. And Eileen, I wanted to get back to you now. You started collecting information in 2017 on who and why people in the Bethel region fall into homelessness. What does this about 5 years of data collection tell you?
The data collection has been a really great way for us to decide what sort of services and infrastructure we needed to build. Everybody's been talking about things being data-driven so that you can make intelligent solutions and intelligent decisions, and so that's what's been really helpful for us. It has shown us that we have about 40 people in Bethel who are experiencing what HUD would define as chronic homelessness and with a disabling condition, which would make them applicable for the permanent supportive housing that we are building. So that's just a nice solution for us to say, all right, this is the infrastructure we need. We have the safety net of the Bethel Winter House, and the next thing that we need is, you know, the full stop housing to end the homelessness for the people who are most chronically homeless and most chronically using all the emergency services that do exist in Bethel. So that's probably been the most important thing for data for us. Also figuring out where people want to live, which it turns out is Bethel. So instead of trying to perhaps just do like a one-time travel back to maybe the community that they come from or Anchorage, the solution is to build housing in Bethel because that is where people want to be. That is where their support network is. And so that's where we need to build the infrastructure.
And I'm sure that it's a myriad of issues that create the problems that people find themselves without housing. But did you find that there were some more than others that really kind of rose to the top as to the problems that people run into? Is it health? Is it what are you finding in that regard?
Well, and there's some things that are, I would say, our data can't measure. I would say, like, historically, there's a lot of historical trauma and institutional racism. That's really what's underneath the iceberg of everything that we're seeing for people who are experiencing the most traumatic outcomes in their lives. So that's not something that the, you know, the coordinated entry list or the, you know, the data that we do during the point in time, I don't think those things are collecting that. But then obviously what we're seeing for people is that they do have like a disabling condition from like what AMHTA would say, you know, is like an addiction issue or a disability issue, traumatic brain issue, those types of things that make it difficult for a person to keep housing or make it difficult for a person to have income or keep a job, which makes it difficult to have a house.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the new housing options being developed in Bethel. It's my understanding there's 24 supportive housing units. And yeah. How did this get put together and when will it be built?
Yes, we're so excited about this because this is also the long-term solution for our funding problems with the Bethel Winter House. Because once those permanent supportive housing units are built, it's co-located with the Bethel Winter House. There's going to be 24 units that are supported if people have income by a percentage of their income, but if they don't, by vouchers through AHFC. And so the vouchers will be able to help support staffing for overnight Bethel Winter House, which is excellent. It's just the cost of doing business and building in Bethel and any place in rural Alaska is so high. We need to have mutual solutions. We need to have shared services for like laundry and water and food and those types of things. So we're so grateful to the capital campaign that is going to build this permanent supportive housing. Bethel Community Services Foundation has been the builder because their executive director, Michelle DeWitt, had the most experience for building. And she amassed plenty of money, mostly from AHFC, which includes money from HUD and the, you know, National Housing Trust. Also a huge investment from Rasmussen, AMHTA, Denali Commission, Widener Apartment Rentals. Our own city of Bethel donated the land that it's going to be built on, and then also a little bit of development money through the Community Action Grant. All told, it's a $7.3 million addition to the Bethel Winter House, basically. And this was out of a converted building. It used to be the senior center that wasn't being used anymore. So the Bethel Winter House moved into that facility, was renovated through COVID money, and then the capital campaign to build permanent supportive housing in the co-located area is, you know, our very creative solution that we're very excited about. So 24 units. We're breaking ground in winter of 2023, and it should be built in 2024. And like I said, from the data that we've accumulated and we continue to accumulate from people who are staying overnight at the Bethel Winter House, we think we'll be able to fill those units up because we have about 32 to 40 people who meet the definition of being able to access permanent supportive housing in that they have chronic homelessness, a very lengthy amount of time, and at least one disabling condition.
You mentioned a wide range of pots of money that brought this all together. Some of it was federal COVID funds that helped remodel the Winter House. Mm-hmm. The mix of partners that are involved in building these 24 units, is this something that you think other communities in the state could look at and model something similar, or was it kind of a rare coalition that came together here?
Well, you know, I don't know. I can't speak for other communities. I know that Nome is also building permanent supportive housing. Mm-hmm. So how they did it is probably unique to their community. But I do think in rural Alaska, all we have is each other, our partnerships. And if we're not utilizing those, then we're not going to make it. So I do think we have an excellent housing coalition with, you know, fewer members than you'd see in an urban area. But I do think that those, you know, unique solutions of having these two facilities co-located, and it's all going to be Bethel Winter House. It's going to be the Bethel Winter House Permanent Supportive Housing. But that co-location is what's going to help be able to support the emergency shelter From the vouchers that are, you know, for the people who are living in the units.
1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation. If you have questions or comments about your community and the needs there, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 907-550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Brian, what can you tell us about the housing that's being built in Nome and how that got put together?
Yeah, it's similar to what Eileen was just describing. In fact, actually, when Eileen was going through the list of funding sources that she was able to leverage through strong partnerships locally, I just had to shake my head because I don't know if Eileen's going to give herself enough credit for it, but to pull that off, to put together one of these projects, it's extremely complicated, especially when you're in a rural community that has limited funding already. Similar to the Bethel Permanent Supportive Housing, the Nome Permanent Supportive Housing is called the Home Plate Permanent Supportive Housing Project. It's about 15 permanent supportive housing units that just broke ground in August. So we're very excited about that. It's a similar timeline. But really the challenge that we have as an organization, statewide coalition, is to how can we make it so it's easier for communities, particularly rural communities, to put together and make these projects pencil. The amount of time it takes to leverage, you know, 20, 25 different funding sources, it's 25 different applications, 25 different presentations to a board, 25 different grant reports, and those timelines don't always match up either. It's extremely complicated, and typically you aren't compensated to do this planning work. And so a big push of both our organization and the Anchorage Coalition is to establish an affordable housing trust, which is a best practice sustainable funding source that's flexible to help fill those funding gaps for communities so they don't have to necessarily leverage 25 different programs. Maybe that's half of that. Or it's a conduit for the application process that automatically leverages different pots of money to help out the folks on the ground who are trying to put these projects together. So it's an easier process. And this last year, this last legislative session, there was we actually were able to establish an affordable housing trust. We were one of three states in the country that didn't have one. And so it's a pretty exciting time for us. We're actually having our first Board of Trustees meeting this afternoon on it to set the policies and procedures so this can be a resource that gets out to the community as soon as possible.
I'm glad you brought that up because I did want to ask you about that Alaska was one of only three states without this housing trust fund. And now it's in place for Alaska. Does that bring together places like the Alaska Mental Health Trust that has land and possibly buildable land in South Central Alaska, and AHFC and others? Are they part of this trust fund establishment, or who's involved in this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's really the goal of this is among all the stakeholders that you mentioned, we actually spent quite a bit of time coming up with this concept with our stakeholders, as well as providers and community leaders and philanthropy on how this can be a mechanism to bring together those different stakeholders to the table in an easiest way possible for applicants and communities to access those funds. And so the way that we're trying to set up the actual funding process is to implement it consistent or at the same time with our other existing funding sources that are funding permanent supportive housing projects or affordable housing projects in the state to make it so we're maximizing the limited resources that we have between all of those different buckets.
All right. Thank you for that. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the issue of homelessness and how Alaskans can help eradicate it on Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance? United Way Healthcare Navigators are here to help you understand your new Affordable Care Act coverage options and opportunity for savings. You can call 211 or text GetCoveredAK to 898-211 to connect to a healthcare navigator. Enrollment is open now through January 15th. Call 211 today. This message sponsored by United Way of Anchorage.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are talking about the issue of homelessness as winter deepens across the state. And we have in the studio with us Meg Zalatel, the Executive Director of the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, and Eileen Arnold, the Executive Director of the Tundra Women's Coalition based in Bethel. And on the line is Brian Wilson, Executive Director of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. How, and this is really a question for all of you, talk about how urban and rural homelessness is connected. How does the urban areas affect rural communities and vice versa? Who wants to start there?
So I'll start as the urban representative, sure. I guess, in the moment. Even urban homelessness is a statewide issue. I don't think it's any secret in Alaska that urban areas and hubs have access to services that lots of rural Alaska doesn't. So when we encounter individuals who have experiencing homelessness in Anchorage, they're from all over the state. And they come to Anchorage for a variety of reasons. And it might be to access medical care or looking for an economic opportunity. And they end up here for a variety of reasons. I think the big myth I would like to dispel is that everyone who ends up in Anchorage or gets, quote, stuck here wants to leave Anchorage. And so it's not only, it's not just a matter of, hey, do you want to go somewhere else? No, it's all about client choice. There are communities developed here once you are here. And so I work very closely with Brian as the statewide coalition to talk about what is this balance of investment across the state that needs to happen to, one, make resources available statewide, and not just housing resources. I mean, obviously, housing's at the crux of this, but also behavioral health services, substance misuse treatment services, just adequate medical services. So we're extremely interconnected. And so I think Anchorage often gets in a bit of a microcosm that, oh, we have this large problem and this is our tough issue to deal with, and we don't look at it in the broader context that we need to advocate beyond, you know, the municipality. We really need to collaborate with the state and have that statewide lens.
And Eileen, what would you say there about that urban-rural connection?
Well, you know, I think an interesting thing about Alaska is there's rural Alaska and then there's like really rural Alaska, because Bethel is a service center for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region, which is an area the size of Oregon. And Bethel's population, you know, between 6,000 and 7,000, but our entire region is population 26, 27,000. There's 56 village communities out there, and a lot of people have to come to Bethel for medical services, for dental services, just like people in Bethel sometimes have to go to Anchorage for the same types of things. And I think that's why you're seeing permanent supportive housing being built in Bethel and Nome first, because we are service centers for our community. So I do think it's all interconnected, because we have the same issue of people in village communities perhaps leaving their village community for medical, for an economic opportunity, because there's not a lot of jobs or housing in the village communities. And while we need to build up those opportunities so that people can stay in the communities of their choice, I know a lot of people who ended up in Bethel who didn't necessarily want to, but there was just no jobs or the house was overcrowded and you needed to. So yeah, I do think it's all interconnected. And, you know, Bethel and Nome are building permanent supportive housing because we too play that, you know, more opportunities, more infrastructure role within our region.
Meg, the Matsu Valley communities do not have any shelters, it's my understanding. What's known about why there are no services in this area that's one of the fastest growing in the state?
That's a great question. And actually, Brian's been more involved with the work in the Matsu Valley. What I can say is, one, we're happy they've identified that they need some kind of an emergency response in that safety net. And two, I think what they're doing in this moment is grappling with what's the right investment. And I think that having the health center there now, the hospital, and some of that infrastructure has really brought to light what maybe wasn't known by the community before. What we what I've learned from Brian is that often in communities where there isn't a homelessness response hub or a center or providers in a robust way, healthcare is often where people land. And so this has come to light. They now have some more information about it. And so they're working on what that plan is.
All right. Brian, let's get you in here now. Pick up there where Meg left off about housing and services in the Matsu Valley. And then from there, we've talked about South Central. We've talked about Southwest, Bethel region. And a little bit about Nome, but haven't talked about Southeast. So give us a little bit of information about what's known about the way forward for the Matsu and then what's happening in Southeast.
Sure. Yeah, Meg actually summed that up pretty well. I'd like to give a lot of kudos to the Matsu Health Foundation for being a regional leader in the Matsu Valley, for heading up and funding the analysis that's been done on the state of need in the Matsu region. Sometimes we just confuse the Matsu region for Wasilla Palmer, but it's a really large geographic area. And from a service standpoint, very limited in the services that they offer. There's been a leadership group that's been formed to discuss the strategic planning of the area and what the immediate needs are. And as Meg said, it's really choosing what that initial investment's going to be. And there has been an emphasis put on sheltered populations. They do exist in the Matsu, and it's they're in the solution creation stage right now for identifying the best way to serve those folks. For the Southeast, it's similar, but it always looks a little different. Obviously, still the hub and spoke system that Eileen spoke of. In terms of rural hubs and rural communities, Juneau, namely, being the largest, followed by Sitka and Ketchikan as well. There's been some really great positive developments in Southeast Alaska. I think one project that's really worth highlighting was a great partnership between the COC, local community nonprofits, and tribal entities at Ketchikan Indian Community, who are standing up a navigational center as well in Ketchikan, which is sorely needed in their community. It's only been a couple of years now that tribally designated housing entities and tribes are able to access pots of HUD funding sources that are earmarked for permanent supportive housing and housing first solutions. And Ketchikan Indian Community was just awarded a pretty decent sized grant to stand up new housing assistance programs in the community. And so we're pretty excited to see where that goes.
All right. Thank you. And I wanted to talk a bit about it. Meg mentioned this earlier, and I wanted to stay with you, Brian, about this idea of the approach shifting to helping people prevent losing housing. It's changed, and the approach is now different, housing first, as opposed to the thinking in the past. Describe how that shift in thinking has changed from where it was in the past and what people thought someone who is experiencing homelessness needed, as opposed to what's being put in place now.
Sure. The easiest way to put it is everybody deserves a house. No matter who you are, no matter what your circumstance looks like, everyone deserves housing. You cannot address all the other complicating factors in your life if you are spending all of your time worrying about where you're going to sleep that night. Mm-hmm. Where are you going to store your stuff? And so we're moving away, thankfully, from this housing readiness idea where somebody has to essentially prove that they are worthy of receiving a housing voucher because they've addressed their mental or behavioral health issues, or they've been able to somehow miraculously improve their income while they've also been searching for a place to stay, to understanding that housing is an essential component of healthcare. And if we can get somebody into a housing solution immediately and surround them with the supports that they need, that they are way more likely to succeed and resolve the issues that led up to that point. And the data is showing that to be true in the existing programs that we have, regardless of the community that it's located in.
All right, we're going to go to the phones for a moment. So if I'm understanding this correctly, in the past, people would be experiencing homelessness, have whatever traumas were going on in their lives because that led them to being that vulnerable, and they were tasked with dealing with everything first before they had a place to stay, having to try to deal with trauma of whatever nature while still being unhoused. That was the thinking.
It's removing the barriers to being able to be accepted into these housing programs. Things like sobriety requirements, things like income requirements, or mandatory participation in different types of services. Mm-hmm. If you eliminate all of that and get somebody into safe and stable housing, they are highly more likely to not only engage in those services, but to not fall back into homelessness.
Sure, they're not in living in crisis in the moment. That makes perfect sense. And
exactly.
I'm glad that the thinking has changed. Let's go to the phones for just a moment. Kristen is in Anchor Point. Hello.
Hello. I just wanted to say to solve homelessness, because this has been an ongoing thing now for several decades in this state. First of all, the state, the boroughs, the communities, they all have to get together and literally commit themselves to building low-income housing for people. The second thing they need to do is an intense education of the communities where they want to build these things, to tell the and show the people who live there that having a low cost income housing area in their area is not going to let loose a huge wave of crime or drug addiction, that the crime and drug addiction probably already exists in their community, and that it's not the homeless people doing it. Many times it's their own children and young people doing it. And therefore, you know, they're just shifting the blame onto somebody else so they don't have to take responsibility for their own actions of what's going on. But yes, you've got to intensely educate people. I see that every time I read about it in Anchorage, where they wanted to do the navigation center in the old Egan Center or one of those places. And there was a huge pushback, a huge blowback, because, oh, drug addicts, oh, criminals, oh, they'll all be running around in the downtown area. And it just wasn't true. There's criminals and drug addicts in the downtown area, but many of them are not homeless. They have homes. They have homes because they steal and they sell drugs.
All right, so you're an advocate of building more affordable housing and helping people get off the street. Thank you for the call, Kristen. We only have about a minute and a half left, and I want to ask each of you before we leave today, what do you want Alaskans who have resources? We heard from Duke, who is helping others because he's able to do that. What do you want Alaskans to do? What's the most effective thing they can do in their community right now? Eileen.
I would say short-term support the Bethel Winter House so that we can make it through this year before we break into some of those funding streams. I want to give like a big kudos, big shout-out to Michelle DeWitt, who's really the person who put together the capital money for the supportive housing. It was not me, and I don't want to take credit for that. And then I also want to give another shout-out to Jayla Milford, the executive director of the Bethel Winter House, who is the one who is running the Bethel Winter House and, saving the lives of people who are there every night. I can't go back to Bethel if people think that it was me. I'm the person on the radio today. I'm not the person doing those things.
All right. Well, I'm sure that you are a part of all of that great work. So thank you for the work you're doing on behalf of Alaskans who really need it, and for being here today. Meg, your thoughts?
Yeah, for those in Anchorage, keep doing what you're doing. We've seen great support from the community. Actually, last night I had an outreach. We were making holiday care packages, and we had so many volunteers show up that what was supposed to take 2 hours took 30 minutes. They were a literal army of volunteers. And when we, this summer, had challenging conditions of heat and rain, supplies showed up. So Anchorage has really been showing up. Just keep it up.
And Brian, one thing you'd like people to do quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, there's no shortage of need in each community, and it looks different depending on where you're at. Even if you don't think that you can, that you have the means to support, sometimes just your time or speaking up at a local meeting, just saying that housing is an important issue that we need to address here locally is enough to start that change.
All right. Thank you so much to Brian Wilson, Meg Zalatel, and Eileen Arnold for being here today to talk about homelessness as a statewide issue. We had engineering help from Chris Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. And on the phones today, Michael Finelli helped us out. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening. And do what you can if you can help others in your community and across the state. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.